This is an interview with Don Gray, who has followed a distinguished career in space tracking and related fields and is currently on consultancy. This interview is taking place today, the 29th of March, 1994. And Don, can we begin with where you were born and how you entered the space tracking industry?
Okay, well, I was born in Melbourne on the 3rd of November 1931, the day White Nose won the Melbourne Cup. As a very young boy, though, I went to Ballarat and spent most of my younger life there, particularly through educational phases through secondary school. In 1949, I joined the Royal Australian Air Force as a radio apprentice. Graduated in 1951, late 51. I was then selected for cadet engineering training, graduated as an engineer in 1954 and was commissioned in the technical branch of the Royal Australian Air Force. I served in the Royal Australian Air Force up until October 1963, when I resigned to take up a position at the NASA tracking station at Island Lagoon, Woomera.
Could you describe how you found out about it and how you actually entered it?
Well, it's a fairly strange story, actually. My last posting in the Air Force, I was seconded to what was then the Weapons Research Establishment, which is now the Defence Science and Technology Organisation. But one of the things at that time that I was engaged in was writing a paper supporting a case for qualification payments to engineers in the services. And from my contacts in WRE, I had given them my resume, qualifications and so forth, asked them what level of appointment I would be likely to be given with them if I was available. And they came to me a little while later. I was getting a bit disturbed that I hadn't got the information, and a rather embarrassed personnel manager said to me, "Look, I'm not allowed to tell you unless you will agree to give serious consideration to the offer." And they offered me a job as a senior engineer at the Woomera tracking station. And I thought it was a very exciting prospect. And so I accepted.
And what year was this?
That was in October of 1963. Well, it was in 63. October was when I actually resigned. So I think I had to give 3 months notice of resignation.
And what did you know about NASA at that stage?
I suppose as an informed layman and a communications engineer, I had taken a great deal of interest in the space program, particularly as I had seen it as having great potential for the communications technology, right from the time of the early passive balloon flights, which were having signals bounced off them as relay stations back to the Earth, and then the development of the later active satellites. I hadn't at that stage even contemplated manned flight space, other than thinking of it in terms of an ambitious project, a noble project. But Island Lagoon, in fact, was involved at that stage in the unmanned lunar and planetary exploration programs, and that was sufficiently exciting for me to accept their offer and go there. I was at Woomera from late 1963 till the latter part of 1967. The major projects that we were involved in then were the Ranger hard landing on the moon and the lunar orbiter program, which mapped the moon's surface as a precursor to later manned flight landings. I left Island Lagoon on a compulsory transfer to Canberra to take up position as Deputy Station Director of the Tidbinbilla Station, specifically responsible for the manned flight activities at Tidbinbilla, which were in fact an adjunct of the Honeysuckle Creek Station, but came under Tidbinbilla management.
Now let's go back to Island Lagoon. Could you describe the living conditions, like where you lived and the transport to work and so on?
Oh, Woomera was a very well-established village. Woomera was the home of the weapons testing program, mainly for the Joint Services Program, the British weapons testing programs. I had seen quite a bit of Woomera in my last posting at WORE. I was the Deputy Surface to Air Guided Weapons Project Officer, and I had been going to Woomera to witness trials of the Bloodhound and Wolfhound missiles. So I went there with my eyes open. I knew what it was like. Woomera was a government town of about 5,000 people at that time. Pretty well established, very tightly controlled too, being in a defence environment. But I had three children at the time, and we had a nice three-bedroomed house in the village, a village with a theatre and a shopping centre, although there were certain things lacking in the shops, and we used to shop also from the tea and sugar train that came through once a week and stopped at the Pimba siding. A village with a theatre, a shopping centre, two Olympic-sized swimming pools, all to serve 5,000 people. It was a very comfortable place to live, apart from the weather, which was very hot most of the time.
How far out was the station?
I'm guessing a little, but it was roughly 10 miles from the village. And there were buses available, a regular bus run that went out. In fact, Island Lagoon had its own bus and its own driver, because there was the deep space tracking station and the mini-track station at Island Lagoon, which was responsible for tracking Earth-orbiting unmanned satellites. Also had the Baikonur camera, which did visual tracking, as well as the mini-track antennas that did the electronic tracking. So it was a pretty well-established space tracking complex.
So when you arrived there, it had already been running for a while?
The first installations at Woomera were not actually at Island Lagoon, but a mini-track system went in for the International Geophysical Year, which was 1959. It was later transferred out to Island Lagoon. The Deep Space Station was commissioned roughly 1961, before my time there, of course. But yes, it had been running for a few years. Like all things at Woomera, they always had trouble getting qualified people to go and live in a remote area like that. Also had the usual problems of public service recruiting, which took an inordinately long time to get people on board, and many of them had developed the habit of eating, so they took other jobs in the meantime.
Of course, it was all public servants in those days.
It started out as a totally public service thing under the Department of Supply. It was not until 1965 that the first contractors were used at Island Lagoon, and then only in the communications section, and then later on again the total operation went over to contractor operation, with just the station director, deputy station director, and an administrative officer fulfilling the government role.
And could you describe your function and what life was like on the station itself?
Well, it was a great station. I think you can find in remote areas people develop a great rapport, a great camaraderie. I was the senior RF engineer. I was responsible for the microwave systems, the antenna, the receivers, the recorders, and transmitters. And it was very early days. Circuits were very much bigger than they were now. We even had valves in some of the equipment. Not too many, I might say. The first of that magic new device, the transistors, were coming into being. Printed circuit boards were a major step forward in those days. We even had our own computer of sorts, which was quite remarkable to be working at that cutting edge of technology in those days. I'd worked on one computer before that in WRE, which was an impact predictor for the guided weapons trials. And it was three rooms of equipment with vacuum tubes, an enormous cooling problem to keep it working, and having roughly the computing power of a reasonable handheld calculator you buy at the local chemist's these days. But the antenna was a sophisticated radio telescope, basically the same design as in use today still. Larger antennas have been built, more efficient antennas have been built, but fundamentally the large disc telescope, radio telescope, is still in use. The low noise performance, we were right in the pioneering edge of that with the first of the cryogenically cooled amplifiers for low noise performance. Incredibly low signals by our standards. Telemetry was vastly different from the today, when they talk in hundreds to thousands of megabits per second. I remember on one of the early planetary explorations, we were proud to get 8 1/3 bits per second through the system from Mars.
I think it was all done with patch cords too, wasn't it?
It certainly was, and they were prone to operator error, I'm afraid. Yeah. But by and large, the people who were there, the station director, Bill Metier, was an Englishman, very well qualified microwave engineer, antenna designer. The deputy station director when I arrived there was a radio astronomer, John Haisler. We had a electrical mechanical engineer by the name of Tadas Zurauskas, who looked after hydraulics and things mechanical. And I became the first senior engineer employed in the electronics area. Later was supplemented with when digital techniques started to come in with another electronics engineer, who incidentally was a colleague of mine as an Air Force apprentice when Don Cox, who later became the station director up there. Most of our people had service backgrounds, the technicians and operators. Navy and Air Force mainly, with a few Army trained technicians. That slowly changed with the distance from the war. More civilian people came in, more civilian trained people came in later.
Now, at that time, did you have operators who weren't trained in electronics, or were they all trained in electronics?
The majority had been of the operators had been people like telegraphists and
So everybody wasn't necessarily a qualified technician?
Oh, no. There was a group who were operators. Fairly small group. And we had technical assistants also, who those invaluable people who used to get all the hard work to do when there were big things to lift. Clean-ups to be done.
And did any Americans visit, or during missions, were there any visits from Americans?
Yes, not the same sort of function as the astronauts performed as capsule communicators with Mercury and Gemini. We used to get visits from various Americans when new equipments were being installed, and they'd bring them out, and they would be more or less responsible for installing the equipment with our own people and checking it out. But we always had the station director was the person finally responsible, back to the assistant lab director at JPL, who was responsible for the deep space network. So although Americans came along with equipment and so forth, they didn't come in the sense of taking over the station in any sense. The station director still was the captain of his own ship. Until Lunar Orbiter. And then NASA had adopted a new philosophy of contracting companies for operational mission phases. And Lunar Orbiter was the first of those we saw where a complete American crew from private enterprise came out and lived in the station and operated the what we called the mission-dependent equipment. And the station was then responsible for the primary tracking telemetry command role, and the American company people were responsible for the operational mission aspects. Boeing was my first experience. They had the responsibility for the Lunar Orbiter program, and that was a new way of doing things and an interesting exercise in management techniques.
That was one of the most successful projects. It was 100% success.
It was, unlike poor old Ranger, which got off to a very sad start. I arrived in time for Ranger 6 in Woomera. In fact, that was my second mission, but the first one was just a very simple, I've forgotten even the name of it, but it was one of the solar telescopes, but Ranger had six. attempts before the seventh was finally successful, and the program was very nearly scrubbed. It was under very severe criticism. Ranger 6 was nearly successful. It did everything except turn the cameras on as it approached the moon.
Could you give a description of a typical pass or a track of, first of all, Ranger? In other words, at the beginning, what the station did, and then Lunar Orbiter.
Yeah. Ranger actually was good training for the later Apollo missions. Ranger was being a lunar program with a final crash landing on the moon. It was roughly a three-day program from launch to finish each mission. We would train for some months ahead of running through various mission phases. Firstly, tracking helicopters or aircraft to exercise the antenna and the people in acquisition techniques and skills. We had simulators which would simulate the downlink we could expect.
Were they local helicopters, or were they...
Yeah, they were hired on from Departments of War, but they were actually RAAF helicopters and aircraft. We used to have one major trouble with them. Those guys were so anxious to please that they used to chase the antenna and fly into the beam instead of the antenna finding them. They used to find the antenna, and we had to beat on their heads a little and go fly with them at times to make sure they didn't do that. We would then link in with the operational control at JPL Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Caltech in California.
And then now, in those days, of course, there wasn't satellite. It was undersea cables and...
Oh, yeah. I think even on occasions, some of our stuff went out over fence lines and down through some cocky's property before it latched into the main communications world. Although WMRA, having had the experience of the weapons testing program, was fairly well off for communications in that day and age. There were microwave links, there were cables, but satellite transmissions or optic fibre, those things were still something in the distant future. Mm-hmm. But we would practice for maybe 2 to 3 months for the three-day mission, and then there would be a worldwide hookup, and the three tracking complexes that were involved were Goldstone in the Mojave Desert in California, the South African station at Pretoria, and WMRA, the main deep space complexes. And we would then have worldwide simulations of the missions, and then the day of truth would come when they would launch it. Like every mission in the early days, there would be countdown started and aborted and started and aborted, and have things like your wife ringing from the village asking when you were coming home, because the ABC had just said the mission was off for 3 days and you were still there trying to crank up your machine to track it. So they were interesting days. Well, typical of then the pastimes, we would come up for a mission, we would, having worked fairly solidly on simulations, usually we would try for a 48-hour break before the mission started. Because of the intermittent nature of the serious tracking commitment, we normally would only have one crew operating, which meant that you would do up to 12 hours of shifts over that 3 days, which was quite reasonable. You know, you could work at that high intensity pace. But came the day of the mission, you would get the latest information available, predicted time of acquisition of the spacecraft, which direction to point your antenna to pick it up. We were at the end of what they called the launch corridor. Early tracking was done by the US tracking stations, and even in those days they were using some shipborne tracking to cover in the ocean area. Then South Africa had probably the difficult part of the early acquisitions, because while there was a nominal flight that the spacecraft was expected to take, launches weren't quite as reliable as they later became, and South Africa used to get the spacecraft when it was at the least predictable time. Remarkably, the South African data would be processed tremendously quickly, and so by the time it came for Woomera to pick the satellite up, or the spacecraft up, provided the launch was going properly, the predictions for us were usually pretty good, and so we would pick it up. But we would then get the first of the long 12-hour tracks, and you would settle down then, and you would have roughly 2.5 days of what we call the cruise phase tracking, a flurry of activity at the beginning while systems were checked out, then a period where the spacecraft was fairly quiescent, just sending back what we called housekeeping telemetry, status of power systems, temperatures, power consumption, all that sort of thing. And then approaching the moon would then be another phase of equipment checkout, readying the systems that were to be used on the actual operation. The general philosophy was to try and have the US station at Goldstone plus one of the other overseas stations, so that there were two tracking stations up at any time. It would depend on particular missions whether that happened to be Goldstone and ourselves, or Goldstone and South Africa. But because you can't alter the geometry of the universe too much, on some occasions it would be just ourselves and South Africa on the thing, with I guess the people back at JPL biting their nails to see what these colonials were going to do to their missions. But in fact, in my view, when it was Australia and South Africa up on a mission, they never had cause to worry. And in fact, both of those stations on occasions were able to perform quite prodigious feats of tracking. I recall one spacecraft went off and the nose cone shroud didn't separate properly, and the spacecraft was still folded up inside, and it went tumbling off into Earth orbit instead of being injected into a moon trajectory. And it was between Australia and South Africa that we were able to chase that thing, work out a possible scenario, because we had a bit of a clue to this, because we got some little signal which was varying up and down quite remarkably, but seemed to be cyclic. So we guessed it was tumbling. We guessed from the signal strength that it was the spacecraft antenna must have been shrouded. We guessed it was then in a low Earth orbit and tumbling, and in fact found it. We didn't, you know, the mission was a failure, but at least the world, and particularly the Americans, knew what had happened to their mission, and I guess it got figured into their later engineering improvements on later spacecraft and launches. Pretty exciting. You would work at very high intensity. Quite often people stayed on the station for the full 3 days. There was no accommodation out there, so you'd find people asleep behind the equipment racks or wherever they could find a place to doss down. Fortunately, there was a kitchen out there, so you were able to be fed. But at the end of 3 days with rather minimal showering and shaving, a fairly dirty crew used to come home. But they were exciting days, and everybody wanted so much for these things to succeed that they would work incredibly long hours under less than ideal circumstances, and I think that carried right on through certainly into the Apollo mission phases as I saw them, through the other lunar exploration, through Mercury, Gemini, and into Apollo. I think it wasn't quite the same in the long planetary missions, because they used to go for months on end, and they became very much a routine shift operation, and you went out and did your bit.
Did you have shifts, or just had the one shift?
In the early days at Woomera, we just had the one shift. Later on, when the planetary missions started to become much longer, we had to go to multiple shifts.
To cover the 24
to
hours.
To cover, certainly to cover 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12 to 14 hours, depending precisely where in relation to the plane of the ecliptic the spacecraft was. And, it was certainly too much to expect. And then, of course, missions now go for years, so people can be on a tracking station for beginning of the mission and long gone before it ever gets to carry out its primary mission objective. So
in those days, did you go from mission to mission? After Ranger finished, for instance, there'd be a lull, or were you tracking all the... Was there something to track all the time?
No, there were lulls. We used to do quite a lot of radio astronomy, using the antenna as a radio telescope. We used to do a lot of...
Was that just for the Americans or the Australians?
It was jointly run. There was a group within WRE of radio astronomers who had an agreement with the Americans. They used to get time on the antenna in their own right, and then in those days, it was very early days of the start of the very long baseline interferometer experiments where you arrayed two antennas a very long way apart to give you the effect of a very much bigger telescope than a single station would provide. And that was done, worked with the Parkes antenna in Australia, and with the Californian tracking stations. Strangely enough, the South Africans also did the same sort of thing, and then later on when South Africa was, I guess, excluded from the space world, like it was from most other things. The Americans shifted their base to Spain. But not until very recent times have they arrayed a global network using up all three of those stations as part of a very large antenna. But only two of them at any time are in operation. As the Earth rotates, you virtually change the antenna from a Goldstone Australian antenna to an Australian Spanish to a Spanish American to an. So it just keeps on.
Yeah, while you're on that, did you have handovers as it set? And for you, say, and it rose for South Africa, did you have a handover system?
Yeah, because of the. They tried to put their stations as near as they could, 120 degrees apart, but you have to have a land mass that exists there. We used to have quite long handover or dual tracking periods, and then the handover with the American end, and a rather shorter one with either South Africa or Spain when it came in. So, but there was a handover, and you would have generally the satellite locked or the spacecraft locked up to one station's transmitter, and then as that was coming down to its horizon and you were rising on the spacecraft, you would hand over control from one station to the next. And I guess that technique became the standard operating procedure for all sorts of satellite operations later on. Okay, we moved from there into lunar orbiter as our next main mission. Lunar orbiter was quite a different concept. We went through all the same sort of preparations and so forth to get ready for the mission. But it was the first of the long-duration missions, because instead of crash-landing onto the moon, taking pictures in ever closer proximity, lunar orbiter, as the name implies, went into orbit round the moon and carried out a photo mapping exercise. It was fairly interesting. It was new to us to have this sort of a mission, a long-term mission. As I mentioned before, the first time we had American contractors on site performing one part of the mission function. It was also interesting the photographic techniques. The film was developed directly on the station, and in the nature of this film, it came out in thin strips of film, which then had to be mosaic to give you the complete picture, the mapping. And that was fairly interesting because the Flat Earth Society saw some of the early mosaics and took it to prove that NASA was conducting a vast confidence trick, and that actually the moon was flat, and they took pictures of it flat and then cut them up and stuck them back together again. It wasn't the first time the back of the moon had been seen. The Russians did that with a single pass over the backside of the moon a little earlier than lunar orbiter. But it was the first time that the back of the moon was mapped in detail. And some enormously large craters exist on the backside of the moon, the one that we don't see. But by and large, much the same terrain as the rest of the moon, the same sort of craters and rills and impact crater patterns. So those missions used to go on, I'm just guessing, but for months on end. And in fact, until the the lunar orbiter spacecraft ran out of consumables was what would eventually finish up each of those missions. But one of the other things that came out of lunar orbiter was the first time that the Earth was photographed from space, looking back over the moon horizon. I look at it now, I've got one of those pictures, and it's a grainy black and white picture, nothing like the beautiful pictures that later came from Apollo, which I also have some of and treasure. But it was very exciting in its time. There were also some interesting little exercises went on there. NASA had sent out a public relations officer along with the first lunar orbiter mission, and he was responsible for releasing any sort of pictures to the press. But there was a little bit of hard feeling because the same pictures were in fact Boeing's responsibility to provide to NASA as mission data. So hanging up, drying around the dark rooms and so forth, you would find these pictures from lunar orbiter. And this guy had a habit of whipping them off, and the next thing you know, it would appear in the Adelaide Advertiser. People had spent days on the station trying to find out what had happened to it, and there you'd find it in the newspaper. So just before he was due to go home, they did a little exercise. They got a currant biscuit, and they dug out the currants from this biscuit, and then they got some bright lights and sidelighted this thing. Then they took some photographs of it, then they cut them up into strips, and then they reproduced them again and hung them up on the drying clips in the dark room. And in due course they disappeared. And we waited anxiously for a long time to see them appear either in a newspaper or New Scientist or Aviation Week, but I think somebody they let him know not to send that lot out, but I think he thought he had another scoop. But we didn't lose another picture off the clips in the dark room after that. But,
did you record data, of course, on the station? Did you send it real time to the States?
No, the interesting thing of the in Ranger, real time picture transmission was not possible. The state of the art didn't exist to send that sort of data directly. So that was all shipped back on tape. Lunar Orbiter, the original film was all immediately packed into very large refrigerated containers, and special shipments, they were flown back within 24 hours to America. But the only real-time data that went back was our normal housekeeping telemetry. The health of the spacecraft was done in real-time, but in those days, mission data was just too large to go over the cables and links that existed around the world in those days.
Like a bandwidth and things like that?
Yeah. Mm. The final failure of Ranger 6 to turn on the cameras when it came down to the sharp end of the mission, I think, was probably one of the most disconcerting and disappointing things that happened in that early space program, because apart from an indication early after launch that something had switched on and off, there was some burst of telemetry, The mission was perfect. The trajectory was right on. The impact place on the moon was exactly as planned. Everything went well. And because it had been going so well, I guess we became overconfident. And we had laid on an enormous party to follow this successful mission. And of course it turned into a monumental wake, unfortunately. But being desert dwellers, you never let a drop of liquid escape, so we did justice to that which had been gathered for the occasion. We wept on each other's shoulders a bit, I suppose, and told stories of how we'd done our bit, but it was one of those sad things. We also had some fear as to whether the program would continue, but I guess because everything else had gone so well, and while it was never finally decided the exact cause of the failure, I think generally it was thought that the TV camera had turned on inadvertently while the spacecraft was still in the Earth's atmosphere, and because all the circuits were designed to work in a vacuum, there'd been a massive arc over, and that was why it didn't work in the finish. But I guess my last memory of Ranger 6 was one of my technicians who later went to Ted Benbiller, and he's dead now, God rest his soul, Jack Dickinson, leaving the tracking station with a large silver punch bowl for a helmet. But that was kind of sad, Ranger 6. But Ranger 7 made up for it, I must say. Absolutely perfect mission in every respect.
Could you describe the scene in the station when, as it approached the final moments, and what happened afterwards?
On Ranger 6, we had
Ranger 7.
Of Ranger 7,
the successful one.
The successful one. Well, I guess because of the experience of Ranger 6, when those final minutes of the mission were coming, there was enormous trepidation. People were they knew what was supposed to happen. They waited out, and those last few seconds seemed like an eternity. Would the TV turn on this time? And came, and without a word of a lie, the all the indications came. Everything happened. The data was coming down. We had pictures coming of the moon. And I think everybody started to breathe again. I'm sure they'd been holding their breath for half an hour. And suddenly there it was. And an enormous cheer went up from everybody. And dear old Bill Mattia, the station director, who stuttered a little, said, steady on, chaps. Nothing like that ever happened with Lunar Orbiter. Lunar Orbiter worked all the time, did everything that it was supposed to do.
Yes, but it wasn't that sort of sudden cut-off either.
No.
Did you have a party at the end of 7, after you had planned such a big one for 6?
We didn't have it set up immediately. we were taking a little insurance, but we had booked the mess for 24 hours later,
right.
So that whatever sort of party it was going to be, we would have it, but not with that immediate letdown feeling we'd had from the previous one. Strangely enough, though, there seemed to appear from all sorts of nooks and crannies afterwards the odd little offering of amber fluid after Ranger 7, but it wasn't the big all-singing, all-dancing party that we'd had before.
And did the Americans recognise anything at all of your prowess?
Of mine personally?
No, of the station. Of the station? For the tracking of the seven.
The station got many NASA awards for excellent performance in lunar and planetary exploration, because without doubt it was a good station. The big rivalry was between ourselves and the South Africans as to which was the best, and we both discounted the American stations as being an adjunct to the whole tracking network, actually. but there were all those. And I remember in the early days of Apollo when they built the various new complexes like Honeysuckle Creek and the one in Spain, we had a station directors conference in Spain, and my South African counterpart was there. And we went out, and on this new Apollo antenna, they'd tracked four different spacecraft. And like the old World War II fighter aircraft, they'd painted a little logo on the side of one of the room that existed up underneath the dish surface. And I remember someone remarking to Doug Hogg, saying, do you do that in South Africa, Doug? And he said, if I did that, my whole antenna would be black.
Okay, well, now let's move on to Tibbenbilla. You moved from Island Lagoon to Tibbenbilla. And what was Tibbenbilla doing at that particular time?
Well, Tibbenbilla was very much concerned in those days with surveyor. I wasn't personally involved greatly in the surveyor missions. I was brought to Tibbenbilla actually to start up the what we call the manned spaceflight wing. The Apollo program generally required two antennas in each location around the world for the lunar phases of the mission, because there was orbiting command capsule and the lunar module separated there, and so the antennas had to swing apart to keep track of each of them. So I was primarily concerned with setting up that wing, checking it out, and integrating it into the manned spaceflight network, and particularly taking care of the operational interface between Tibbenbilla and Honeysuckle Creek, which was the prime manned flight station. Prime Apollo manned flight station, let me say, because my friends from Carnarvon always reminded me that they were actually the prime manned flight station, having existed from time immemorial or somewhere back around there. Of course, people from Newshay thought they were newcomers anyway. But I did get involved to some extent with Surveyor. The station director at Tibbenbilla, Bob Leslie, after I'd been there about a year, moved on, and I then was acting station director for a period and then became the station director. So I found I had a fairly quick learning curve on Surveyor to go through. That was a good mission. That was a soft landing on the moon, a precursor to the later Apollo landings. Checking things like soil bearing capabilities, the actual size of the rocks and boulders and anything, in fact, that would assist the astronauts later when they had to land a manned craft on the moon. I do remember, in fact, while I was still at Woomera, we backed up Didbinbilla on the first Surveyor landing. It was just an insurance thing. We weren't the prime station, but we did in fact track the first Surveyor. But as soon as Didbinbilla was up and locked onto it and taking good data, we switched off and then just listened to it as an exercise of some interest. But I remember Dr. Pickering, who was the very famous New Zealander who was the assistant lab director for tracking and data acquisition. The first Surveyor landed on the moon. It didn't fall over as some people had predicted by landing with one foot up on a boulder. It didn't sink into the fine dust, which was going to be hundreds of metres deep and not support anything. It sat on the surface of the moon and started sending back pictures and telemetry and all sorts of good stuff. And Dr. Pickering came on the line congratulating all concerned, but his remark was that we had a disastrous success on our hands because everybody was really prepared that mission would fail because of the unknowns of the landing and what the moon's surface would actually be like. And the thing sat there and sat on its legs, and its TV cameras panned around and took beautiful pictures. We spent a lot of time while we were working out while JPL was working out what to do next, of the cameras looking at the legs of the spacecraft and looking at how far they'd sunk into the Earth, and then sort of doing pans around saying, oh, that'll be an interesting rock to look at later.
Were you able to see the pictures in the station, or did you have to wait for them to come back?
We were able to watch a monitor. Again, this was a mission where an American company had that mission-dependent responsibility. That was Hughes Aircraft. And they had a TV converter on which we were able to see the pictures. And a slow scan version of that was actually sent back in real time, if I remember rightly, but the high resolution pictures were forwarded by on tape for later processing back at JPL. But that was pretty exciting stuff, particularly on the later Surveyors, which then had a little digging arm, which went out and dug trenches and pulled in rocks and stuck them up under the TV camera's eye to have close looks at them.
So what was the atmosphere in the station?
I think pretty much as Dr. Pickering said, total amazement that the thing was still in one piece and transmitting. That was the first soft landing on another body in our solar system, and it took people's breath away, and it was so successful. And I guess particularly after the experience of Ranger, where there had been so many failures before they got a successful one, here this thing worked right from the start, and I think was very instrumental in setting the scene for the later Apollo landings, because things like the the bearing strength of the moon's surface and so forth, now were supported by good solid engineering data. I know one leg landed not very far away from a big rock, but it didn't land on a big rock and tip the spacecraft over, so... great excitement on any mission success on a tracking station. Also that, like I said, that letting out of your breath, you've held your breath for, and I don't know, prayed to whatever gods you pray to for success, and suddenly it all happens, and there's that...
Great relief,
and then the moment of truth. My God, it's successful. Now the mission really starts.
Right. Okay, let's move on to Apollo. Now, you were responsible for the wing.
Yeah, the Tidbin Willer wing initially, and...
we might as well start with Apollo 11. Can you remember?
Yes.
Because you were responsible for tracking the command module.
Yeah. I guess in a sense we might have felt a little like Michael Collins. He sat in the command module and orbited the moon while the other two did the big memorable stuff, and Honeysuckle Creek and later Parkes did the memorable stuff on pictures from the moon and so forth, and we kept
housekeeping on the CSM.
Housekeeping on the command and service module, but I think we had the same sense of excitement as everybody else at this thing happening. I have to admit to having had a sneaky look at the pictures from Tidbin Willer also. When the command module was behind the moon, we were able to swing in and have a quick sneak peek. I guess like everyone in the world, the fact that men had now set foot on another heavenly body was just mind-blowing. I think we also felt we were providing a valuable service to that mission, in that had the command module not been there when the astronauts wanted to come home, they wouldn't have made it. And I guess that was... Michael Collins is feeling too, that that was an integral part of the mission and it had to be there for the mission to be complete. The command module did some mapping exercises too of moon surface, which was useful for later missions. But I guess we were pretty proud to be part of that mission, like anybody who had any part in it. We'd also been trained in case of, any sort of operational problems.
You used to partake with us with the simulations of the aircraft.
Yeah. So we were quite capable of doing the photographic, or the TV mission, had it become necessary for whatever reason. But
I remember during Apollo 8. Honeysuckle had a lot of trouble with its feed cone.
Yeah.
And there was a period there they couldn't track.
Yeah, there was indeed. And I think that showed the value of having the dual complex, was that each could substitute for the other in virtually any mission phase. I think one of the missions I remember particularly was Apollo 9, and that was the mission in which the command and service module and the lunar module linked together, went into Earth orbit, and then separated to check out the docking procedures, the separation and then the re-docking procedures and so forth. And the mission had been planned such that it was expected that on the Australian end of it, Honeysuckle Creek would be tracking, I think from memory, the command module. There was a problem from Tidbin Miller's point of view. Its antenna was much slower than much lower acceleration and velocity capability than the Honeysuckle Creek antenna.
That's because it was designed for tracking deep space.
Because it was designed for tracking in deep space, and so most of its life it only needed to move at sidereal rate. But there came a period where there was a requirement for both elements, the command module and the lunar module, to be tracked. And in particular, they needed to get commands into the lunar module. And the one antenna, the Honeysuckle Creek antenna, couldn't see both spacecraft at that particular critical point in time. And the Tidbin Biller antenna wasn't capable of following either of them in Earth orbit at the
high speeds.
At the high speeds that the Earth orbits occurred in. And it, at one stage, almost was thought that they would have to abort part of the mission. This was in planning beforehand. Because of this problem of just at that one critical time needing commands for it. And we sat down at Tidbin Biller. One of the things we had on our antenna was an acquisition antenna, which had a very much wider beam width than the main lobe. We also had a pretty good high-powered transmitter. And so we came up with a scheme and put it to NASA that we would use that acquisition antenna with its very wide beam width. We would drive the antenna under computer control from horizon to horizon. We would catch the spacecraft in the leading edge of the antenna beam as it came up. And we would send that thing at its maximum possible rates all the way across the sky, and the spacecraft would come up, and it would in fact catch up and fly through this wide beam width and then out the other side of it. But it would be in the beam width for a significant period, which covered that critical time, and we would blast the spacecraft with our high power transmitter, and just transmit the commands continuously and get them into the spacecraft. And NASA accepted that as the operational procedure, and that in fact was, I think, one of the best things we ever did. We knew our equipment well enough in Australia to be able to make those sort of proposals to NASA. And they trusted us well enough to accept their word for it. Mind you, they did send an aeroplane out here and check it out for hours on end as well to see that we could do it. Well, I think we terrified some of the aircraft crew with blasting them with our high-powered transmitter, but it was because it was going through the acquisition aid antenna, it was at fairly low intensity at the aircraft. So, but that was a very good exercise. I was very proud of the Tidbin Biller crew. We had one mission where the transmitter high voltage power supply blew up on us on just near the end of a track. I've forgotten which mission it was, in fact. I probably could ring find out by going through my souvenirs, because I remember Tom Reed, the director of Honeysuckle, sent us a congratulatory message afterwards. We blew, and my people worked continuously, rewound a huge transformer between Apollo tracks and had the transmitter up and on the air the following day. I guess one of my proudest possessions coming from my days in the space tracking world is the letter of thanks I received from Armstrong, Aldrin and Collins, congratulating me actually on receipt of the NASA Achievement Award, and thanking me and my station's crew for the excellent support they had received in their mission. But it is an original, signed by all three of them, and it hangs on my wall.
And I think that's a good point to finish on.
Yeah.
And thank you very much, Don Gray.